Welcome to the One Big Thing podcast, where inspiration meets transformation. I'm Steve Campbell, your host, and I invite you to embark on this exhilarating journey with me. Are you searching for that extra spark, that push to propel you in the right direction? Look no further. The One Big Thing is all about bringing you incredible guests from diverse backgrounds. So picture this: professional athletes, visionary business leaders, fellow podcasters, and even awe-inspiring stay-at-home moms who are all conquering life's challenges. Get ready to seize your moment of greatness. Don't miss out. Subscribe and follow the One Big Thing podcast today. Welcome back to the One Big Thing podcast. I am your host, Steve Campbell. Always an absolute honor to steal a little bit of time with you to help you move the ball forward in your life. If you're brand new to the One Big Thing podcast, this is an interview style show where I have the gracious ability just to walk you through incredible people that are doing incredible things to help tell their story. Well, today is no different. I have my guest, Dana Casperson, on. We're going to spend a little bit of time, for those of you who may not know her but should, a little bit of her story and what she's learned. So I want to get right into it and welcome to the One Big Thing Studio podcast, Dana Casperson. Dana, welcome in. For those that may not know you, why don't you take a few minutes here at the beginning, introduce yourself and let people know kind of who you are.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the invitation. It's great to be here. I am coming to you today from a couple of different angles in my life. The last 40 years, I've been working also as a performing artist in the field of dance as a creator and performer. And in that time, I worked most of the time in Germany in a traveling company that toured internationally. And that was a very creative space. It was a place where people collaborated constantly. Things were changing all the time. We were finding new ways for things to happen that had happened before. We were finding ways for things that happened before to happen again in a different way. And sometime in there, I started to notice how much damage was done when conflict became destructive. And there happened to be a lot of conflicts that came up in different areas of my life. And I recognized that I was like, there has just got to be a better way for this to go. And I recognized that I didn't have the skills, or I just didn't understand what was happening. I didn't know what to do. And at that point, a friend of mine dragged me to a workshop. They were like, you have to come see this guy. It was Marshall Rosenberg who started nonviolent communication, which is an approach to dealing with conflict. And I went there and I really had a literal aha moment where suddenly I couldn't speak. And I've never had that before or since, where I was like, I see, it doesn't have to be this way. Like, there's literally another way to do this. And that was the beginning of my own practice of starting to think about, okay, what am I doing? What's the impact of what I'm doing? What are my communities doing? What's the impact of that? And I practiced on my own for a while. And eventually I started to notice how when the attention that we give in conflict shifts from the attack defense arena down to this level of what really matters to people, because people get into conflict because something matters to them. When we shift the attention down there, even if only one person can shift the attention, it starts to unfold what's going on in a much more beneficial way. And I eventually started to study more and more. And then I went and got a master's degree in conflict studies and mediation. And so for the last 12 years or so, I've been working often at the intersection of choreographic design, which means how does the way we set up situations shape what happens inside of a situation? And that can be physically, that can be in terms of time and tempo and space and invitation and all kinds of different categories, at the intersection of that and of conflict thinking. And so I work in a lot of different ways. My main interest is how do people develop their own capacity to step into difficult conversations, to be able to sit in uncomfortable places long enough to find out what matters. Because very often our desire is just to like, get out of here. And we leap out and we start trying to solve it before we really understand what's happening. So developing that capacity to be present in a way that is constructive by finding out what matters, holding those things together, and asking questions like, all right, what would it look like if we did find a way forward? So developing that curiosity in difficult spaces. And I work with people in a lot of different ways. So I work as a coach with individuals. I work as a trainer. I do a lot of training actually during the pandemic. Discovered that training online and with conflict stuff works really well. So I'm doing that a lot recently. And I work with groups, companies, and organizations who are ready to think about what their current conflict culture is, what the unspoken rules are or the spoken rules, what they would like to move toward, what needs to happen to get there, what needs to be prevented, what needs to be enabled, how is that impacting individuals and the organization, and what kind of work can happen in the individual and in the organization. And then I also do work with dialogue design. So I work, and this is often very much integrating choreographic thinking. How do we create spaces where people are able to enter into difficult topics as a group? Oftentimes I do large-scale public dialogues. And I've worked quite a bit over the last few years with the Michael Douglas Collective, which is a group of artists in Germany. And we've created several models that look at different things, violence, racism, polarization. And those projects are ways to think about how we typically talk about difficult topics in our society and in our communities, and how the use or the recognition that the body is always involved, that space is always involved, that configuration is always involved. There's many different categories that we're already making decisions in, and how is that shaping what happens in situations? So I work oftentimes creating models that people can use to work on thinking together about different things. And so those are the, and I'm also a writer. So I'm interested in also how can people have things that can help them practice. So how do people practice on their own? So I wrote a book called Changing the Conversation, the 17 Principles of Conflict Resolution. And the goal of that book was, how do I write the shortest book possible that is useful? So because a lot of people don't want to sit down and read a giant book about conflict resolution. So this book is oriented toward ways that we can check back in. Like, for example, I've been working on a set of cards that come from the book. So for example, principle one is, don't hear attack, listen for what's behind the words. And then the book is also organized that it has anti-principles, because I find that's often helpful. It's easy to say like, yeah, don't hear attack. But then to notice like, what is it when we're doing the anti-principle would be hear attack, ignore any additional information that's being offered. So often we do that. We just hear the attack because attack is so seductive and so obvious, and we start responding to the attack. So so that book is oriented toward that. I have a second book, which is coming out hopefully soon. And and I'm working on things that people can use, like these decks of cards. I'm making a practice book. So that's another way I really enjoy writing and creating things that people can use to practice on their own.
Well, it's exciting to have you on this podcast today. And if you have never checked out a One Big Thing episode, let me, as the host, kind of give you a little bit of insight as to how these shows go. We have had guests really from all walks of life. So if you're here championing Dana today, welcome in. We hope that it's not only your last visit, but that you'll check out other episodes. And I have guests from all walks of life. It's been very interesting as I have source guests, kind of the differences in backgrounds, ages, generations, and there has just been a really sweet balance of guests. And what I've always told listeners is, even if you've never done choreography or you've never written a book, don't tune out, because there's going to be a lot that we all deal with conflict that I believe from Dana you can really learn from. But our introduction kind of came by way of, in my business, one of my colleagues had us watch a TED Talk, We have an internal mentorship program to try to teach culture and work with our staff. And for those that are in the mentorship program, Kayla had brought this TED Talk taught by Dana Casperson that was going to talk about conflict and how to work through it, especially in the workforce. And I just really appreciated that conversation that I had reached out to you on LinkedIn and saw that we had a couple of common connections. And I thought, what's the worst that can happen? I can send her a message. And if I never hear back from her, that's okay. But you got back to me relatively quickly. And why I wanted to have you on the show, because the one big thing is all about bringing people practical insights. You know, most of my listeners, when you look at statistics, typically fall within the 30 to 40 year old range when you can see kind of who listens to the show, which is great. Because for many of us, I'm 37, married, 4 kids, running businesses. I am in the thick of a season of life where sometimes it can feel like you never get a break. You never get a chance. Mm-hmm. And if you're not careful, you can find yourself kind of waiting for this, falling in love with this next season of life that you tell yourself that just we believe will be easier and more comfortable. And I just don't think it's going to be. And so part of my goal as a host is to make sure that listeners don't throw away life waiting for the next season or waiting for the next chapter, but learning how to gain insights that can help you thrive whatever season you're in, whether you're with children, without children, whether you're at the pinnacle of financial success or barely getting by, whether you are in a career for a life or you have literally spent years going from job to job to job. But what I think is very cool about your story, and you kind of just shared it, is that you had this aha moment. And I think from what I understand, you can correct me if I'm wrong, you were doing choreography at the time. And I should acknowledge that you are an award-winning choreographer and dancer. So there are some accolades to your name that I want to make sure that our guests know for you personally. But I believe you were doing choreography and you were invited to this event. And this light bulb went off about conflict. And I don't know if conflict was really anything that you were engaged with or more just curiosity sparked that you came in because of your passion for dance, but learned about conflict management. And was that, is that kind of what I heard from you?
Yeah, exactly. I was a full-time performer and creator at the time and experiencing a lot of conflict that really wasn't going well. And at that moment, when I heard Marshall Rosenberg talking, I suddenly felt, I understood that it would be possible to do it differently. Yeah.
Well, and that's why I want to park there for 1 second, because I am a huge advocate and encourager of people. A lot of my life has been a lot of things that just kind of happen that I don't really know why, but it's always worked out. And there may be people listening today that your, what you did was dance, what you did was choreography. But when that thing got you into a place that you really needed to be, a light bulb went off that sparked something that typically doesn't have anything to do with what you did for a living, but so stirred you in a way that you started down this path of discovery of how could you incorporate conflict with dance. And why I'm saying this is because I think maybe why people my age are struggling with the season of life that they're in is because the what they do and the passion hasn't quite aligned. And they're hoping that when they just go do their job or their career, that they're going to have the moment that you described. But what I have found is for many of our listeners, they're doing careers that they never went to school for. So like, how do you make sense of that? I spent all this time going to a university, getting a degree, and I went to school to be a teacher. I don't teach at all in a formal sense, but I teach every day in another way. So if you just looked at my resume and track record, it doesn't make a lot of sense for what I set out to do. And I think there's a lot of people that are in that state, which is they're not quite sure of what they're doing today. They're trying to make sense of it. But what's great about your story is you're a little more seasoned. You've been along farther in now kind of sharing backwards lessons that you've learned. Your passion or your level of discovery with conflict management just happened because you went to a particular place and you were, you know, intrigued by what you heard. And so what I always try to help on, you know, people my age understand is the big things in life, the catapult moments typically aren't planned. It's just you go about your day, you get an invitation to a thing, and you go and you do it. And then it's almost like this epiphany happens of like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And so I think what's hard is so many young people are trying to constantly strategize how to change the season of life that they're in and how to make the right move in their career or do the next thing that will give them a sense of peace and passion. But what you're saying in your story is you just happened to be invited and went to a thing that launched you into writing books. And so like part, I'd love to kind of unwind that a little bit because that's the part of the story that I love. Is life is not always neat. Life doesn't always follow a linear path. You set out for school and you do these things, you get married, you have children, and you're just happily, you know, the rest of your life. A lot of times the people that I see that are shaking the world up and making a change and influencing others, if you actually peel back the onion of their life, it just kind of like happened because they were in the right place at the right time and they heard the right message and they did something about it. How could you maybe inspire or encourage a listener today that is maybe in that path of feeling like, is there something different? Or they're curious to know, like, how, like, what steps did you take to kind of combine conflict with dance? So take it wherever you want, if that resonates with you. But
yeah.
I think this is worth kind of sticking on for a moment.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, whatever, how many, 20 years down the line here, what I'm recognizing now that folds back to that time, but I didn't see it then, is that if I think from the perspective of conflict, every conflict is proposing constructive change. So the tensions of the conflict itself are like a map that say, here's where this thing is happening, here's what's impacting it, here's what it means might be possible. So possibility is contained inside the tension of the thing that feels horrible. Because it wouldn't feel horrible if there weren't tensions, and the tensions wouldn't be there if there was something that you wanted that's not being met at the moment. And so inside that, this whatever situation you're in that feels like this is not it, I don't know what's happening, I don't know how to move, that you already have a map of what you care about that can guide you as you, when you start to move out in different directions to help you understand, is this feeding back into what my spirit needs, let's say. And inside of those moments. So for example, I went to that workshop. I was like, I actually literally went up to him afterwards and tried to say thank you, but I couldn't speak and I burst into tears. And I'm not a person who bursts into tears very easily, but something hit me so hard that I was like, okay. And now I recognize what it is that I understood that we're already always in a practice. So wherever you are, you're already practicing something every day. And that practice is entirely up to you. And what you choose to do every day determines your mindset and determines what you're capable of choosing in stressful situations. So that for me connects dance to conflict because a dancer, I think of them very similar. The way dancers practice is they don't say, okay, I'm going to learn this thing. I'm going to get it perfect and be done. Because the body is adaptable. It builds on what is done. What you do the most is what what it's able to do most fluently. It unbuilds what you don't do. So every day dancers come back into the studio and they don't repeat, but instead they reconnect to an idea. So there's a physical idea and I'm reconnecting to that idea every day. And it's not about getting it perfect. It's about understanding how I can access those ideas even in stressful times. So what I understood at that moment where I suddenly couldn't speak was that I have the capacity in myself to start practicing something different. And if I practice something different, I'll be more capable of moving through these difficult situations I'm experiencing.
Yeah, I think what I heard from part of your story and maybe where the difficulty is when you're a dancer and your performance is however long down the road, every day you practice preparing for that performance and no one sees the background of leading up to it. They just get to be a consumer and enjoy the dance. But when you are a human and you're married and you have children, every day you have to perform. There is no practice because you are always constantly in the thick of it. And I think if we're not careful, we can misdiagnose what is actually happening. Where, you know, for my wife and I, our kids are so young and they're so moldable. They're wild. And it's very easy as parents to feel like, are we doing something wrong when they don't listen? Or, you know, our big thing that, you know, we struggle with right now, which is also a blessing at the same time, is when they're in school, they're fantastic. They're well-behaved. When they're at church, they're well-behaved. Every authority figure that we ever talk to that watches our children says, you have the best kids. And yet, if I had a webcam on my head at night of what takes place when they're not in those areas, work can be going extremely well. My marriage can be going well. But as a parent, I feel off because the thing that I'm practicing or performing every night is not working in the way that I want it to, that it almost creates inner conflict with yourself. And, you know, you don't want to complain because again, if you're not careful, when you're in this season of life with kids, every relationship with another couple or sets of couples can be almost a therapy session for how quote unquote bad your kids are, or did I tell you what my kid did? When it's not even the life breathing relationship that it should be of a friendship of building each other up, they're more just opportunities for us to share the things that we just wish were different. And so I think what I'm kind of hearing and what I'm excited about that you're bringing to the conversation is that conflict is inevitable, but there's mindset, there's choice. So how do we get an individual, and there's always layers to it, right? So when you're an individual, you're an individual. When you're married, it's you and somebody else. So it's not just you making decisions anymore. When you bring children into the world, it's almost like three layers. You don't even have time necessarily to always work on yourself because of the demands of raising children. So by the time you've done that aspect of your life, then you get with your spouse and maybe they bring things to your attention that need to change or communication things. So now you feel like I'm exhausted from raising kids. And now you're telling me that I need to be different. This is awesome. Thank you so much. And then you finally get to yourself where you're like trying to make sense of maybe failing as a parent, which isn't true. No one is. Parents, let me give you a little grace. You're not failing. It's just hard, right? You're not failing. In your marriage, you're with your best friend, person knows you that, you know, better than anybody else. So they're going to point out things because it's a safe space. But then you're by yourself. So you're by yourself, you know, in the car, you're by yourself at work, and you have all of these competing emotions and feelings of thoughts of things that you've dropped the ball on, or, you know, a spouse saying that you need to change in a certain way, and it sticks with you. Those are all conflict. So how do we, from your world of writing books and teaching workshops, how do you begin to make, if you sat one of these parents that listens to the show in front of you, like how would you even begin to unwind the constant battle that they face every day of being in that performance mode as a parent, you know, as a spouse?
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. That's really loaded, Dana. I am sorry. No, loaded. This is good for me.
Yeah. This is such an important space because it's so challenging to be a parent. And it's, as you say, it's so relentless. It can feel so relentless. And what, I heard one time a story, one of my teachers told this story about how when he was learning, he started writing things down on a card because he flipped out all the time on his kids. And he was like, I just have to find a better way to not flip out on them. And so to step back a minute, what I mean by practice is not that you need to like buy into some new way of thinking about conflict and then, you know, get the book and do that, but instead to notice, okay, oh my God, what am I paying attention to daily? What in the kids am I paying attention to? Am I utilizing punishment and reward as tools that are tools of control? Or am I shifting my attention to, expressing what matters to me on the level of what I need, what I'm interested in the situation? For example, I want a situation where everyone, is able to agree to a plan. And our little kids is tricky, I know, but that there's some kind of a common understanding of what we're planning to do, for example. that's an interest, as opposed to, I want you to get into your room and clean it up right now. So to notice the difference between what you need on a deeper level, which, for example, I heard you just now maybe naming, you need space where you have time for yourself as an individual and as a couple and as a parent, what it means to have needs, and then these interests, which are in the situation, which is, I'd like in the household, I'd like us to have agreements that make sense enough for everybody, that we're able to some degree to stick to them. And then there's strategies, like go to your room, clean your room. That's a strategy that's trying to meet those other needs. And so the story that my teacher told me was, he had written down on a card for himself a little thing that said, for example, I'm feeling really frustrated when I see that you didn't clean your room, because it's important to me that when we agree to something, that we all are able to agree to it. I want to understand what's getting in the way of that, and what we can do to make it so that everybody really can stick to the plans that we make. Can we sit down and talk about that? So he had that down. What I see, my feeling, what I care about, what my request is. And he carried it around. And then one day he had forgotten his card, and he got into a fight with his daughter. And his daughter said, Daddy, go get the card. So the daughter recognized, the child, you know, children recognize where you're speaking from. Are you speaking from a punitive level because you're just so stressed out, you don't know what else to do? Or are you constantly, you know, looking at your attention and saying, where am I placing my attention? Am I focused on expressing what's important to me, even in those moments where I get stressed out? And what I mean by practice isn't that you need to change yourself, but instead have a practice of noticing where your attention is and which actions you're choosing and how those actions are impacting you and the people around you.
It's really good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and I know a little while ago you had some cards held up. Did want to remind you that you can obviously listen to this podcast on every major podcast platform, but you can also head over to YouTube at NQR, Not Quite Right Media, and watch along. And so I know, Dani, you've had some visuals. So if you want a chance to kind of see her and see us working together, you can check out that video. But I think that's a huge part of it, right? So when you are trying to better yourself, most people listen to a podcast because they want to receive a resource. Maybe you're the person that loves the murder mystery podcast or true crime or what have you. But when you make podcasts, you have to categorize what type of show you have. And this would be considered an educational, self-help, how-to kind of podcast. So if you're on this, you're probably here because, one, you want to champion Dana, but also you're hoping that some way, somehow, we together, she speaks to some area of your life that you're like, that breakthrough aha moment that she had, you can have. And I believe that can happen. So when you're here, I think that's part of what people are struggling with. They're on a podcast because they're trying to improve themselves. And again, maybe one area of their life or two or three is going extremely well. But when it comes to being a parent, they can run the greatest business meeting all day long and have people at work that champion them, or customers or clients that love them. But when they come home, they drop the ball a lot. They drop their ball a lot because they get to a point where they're raising kids or even with their spouse where tensions are high. They're feeling worn out as it is. Maybe it's because they gave themselves all day long to other people, and now they're in the safe space. They're in their home. Their guards are down. And when your guard is down and you have kids that expose parts of you that you just don't want to admit are actually there, you know, most young parents would have never imagined, depending on what type of parent they had, that they would ever raise their voice, you know, spank, threaten, escalate a situation. You know, it's so easy as a parent when you're in the midst of something to throw out these crazy extreme statements that you can never actually back up. Like, if you don't go clean your room, you're not going to go to grandma and grandpa's house ever again. It's like, there's no way that you're like, but you're hoping that they're going to be like, okay, I'm going to go clean. And then they don't. And now you're like throwing out another Hail Mary, being like, well, if you don't clean, I'm throwing all your toys out. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then your kids start to pick up on that, whether it's, you know, your friend that had the card or whatever. Our kids notice things in us. So when I hear from listeners a lot. They're like, I just need more when it comes to parenting, when it comes to being married. And I think what you're sharing is just like, how would you even begin to, if we're all being honest and we close our eyes and we think about that relationship in our life mm-hmm. that is a place of pain sometimes or is exhausting, mm-hmm. what is that for you as a listener? When you close your eyes, is it just being a parent? Is it just right now things between you and your spouse aren't where you had hoped that they would be? Whatever it is, be honest with yourself. How would you, from your experience in what you've done, how would you even begin to give someone practical steps? Because if you've been feeling this way, most likely you didn't just show up at this podcast listening and this just started today. This has probably been a period of time that you've been feeling a certain way and you are actively trying to get out of it. How would you even begin? And I know there's no, you know, silver bullet or magic steps, but what would somebody like this that's feeling this way, what would they need to do begin to maybe unwind some of this?
Yeah. First, I just want to give a little tool. There's a great book called How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and How to Listen So Kids Will Talk. That is a fantastic book. It has, it also has visuals in it, and I would really recommend that to parents. So one first step I think can be to recognize what the conflict culture is in your family. You know, if there's been a lot of shouting happening, to be transparent about what you're looking for and to say, for example, to sit down and say, okay, let's have a family meeting. So we're going to take a moment out of time when we're not already stressed out on the way to the car. You know, nothing happened, didn't clean the room. You're not going to your grandparents. And instead say, let's have a family meeting for 10 minutes. Okay. I've noticed that we're shouting at each other a lot. And I don't like that because it's important to me that we have communication that feels good to us all and that we're able to talk about things that matter. And kids understand that. They feel the tension of shouting, for example. And if you create a space that's like, this space for this 10 minutes is for us to talk about how we talk about stuff. And to know that conflict's going to happen, like you say, conflict is inevitable, and to actually have a plan for it. And it doesn't mean the plan's going to be perfect, but it can be as simple as saying, let's sit down for 10 minutes, have a family meeting. Let's talk about what we don't like and what we like when we talk to each other. And then if we find ourselves shouting again at each other, we can have some signal, for example. Oop, we're shouting. Okay, what was our plan to do when we're shouting? So that you have something that's between you. So it's not like you're on opposite sides of this thing, but you figure out what is the question between us? Is it like, what will we do when we're stressed out and we're still trying to talk about something? We find ourselves shouting. Okay, our plan was that we're going to take a step back. We're all going to be quiet for 10 counts. We're going to exhale slowly, get our parasympathetic system back online, and then we're going to try it again. And we're going to focus in on the level of what really matters to us and try to connect at that level. And even if it's not perfect, if the kids know there's an intention to have a way of being together, it can help them also trust that, for one thing, that they can't just get away with stuff. But also that they have a place where if they're unhappy about how things are going, that they can also say something. And maybe it becomes a regular thing. Like, we're going to have a weekly 10-minute meeting where we talk about how it's going with how we communicate, for example. That's a first step, is to recognize what the culture is, to identify what the culture is that you want, and then to keep checking back about it. So not to assume that you're going to be like, we got it. You know, like a dancer can't say, okay, good. I have that turned down and it'll be down forever. Every day we need to go like, oh, I'm falling out of the turn because I dropped my elbow. Let me see if I get back. Let me try that again. That we're in practice with each other. Like you say, it might feel like a performance that you're failing, but in fact, it's just this ongoing kind of circular practice where our spirits are being shaped by what we choose to pay attention to, what we choose to respond to in the other person, and what we choose to offer them.
Well, and I think your analogy that you just gave is even helpful for myself as the host of the show, because I think sometimes we can assume, maybe wrongfully, that because we had a conversation, that from this point on, we're all on the same page. in your simple, you know, analogy of dance, that, you know, even if you feel you got the move down, you still have to keep practicing it. I think maybe that's where people have a disconnect. It's like, okay, I listened to the episode. I sat my family down. We had a 10-minute meeting. Everybody said, we agree. Good. And then 2 days later, we went right back to shouting. And it's like, are we broken? Mm-hmm. And I think what has helped my wife and I, which is what you said, if you are tired of being tired, you probably have to do something differently. Mm-hmm. Right? We can all acknowledge that we're tired, we're worn out, or you're living your best life. You know, this is not a somber podcast. It's just being very honest with a lot of people I talk to that don't always have a space to talk about the struggles that they have internally in their marriages and as parents. But if you are getting up, getting your kids out to school, bringing them home, making dinner, it's chaos, getting them ready for bed, it's chaos. And then you have 1 hour to yourself at nighttime, that you're not living. And you can't assume that you just get a good night's rest and your kids are going to have this epiphany while they sleep of, you know what, I should probably listen to my mom and dad tomorrow. But if you want to have change in your life, then you probably have to start to begin to implement different rhythms and routines to life. And this was something that a book that my wife and I had read together, which had just talked about some of the most chaotic parts of our day are getting the kids off to school in the morning and then putting them, you know, down to bed at night. And it was just chaos. And this book had basically championed that children actually do respond well to routine when it's consistent. Mm-hmm. They go to school. Mm-hmm. They have organizations. And if you will begin to make them not punitive, but opportunities, and the hard part maybe is the age of your kids and the maturity level, but if you will begin to implement certain rhythms to life, we're going to meet for 5 minutes in the morning before school and talk about one blessing that we each have in our life. We do at dinner time, we do what we call pits and peaks. So this came from a neighbor of mine who did it with my kids and it stuck for the last year and a half. When we sit our kids down for dinner at night, we say, give me a pit and give me a peek from today. So obviously a peek being something that happened that was really great, and a pit maybe something that wasn't so good. And what it does is it gets kids to talk. And it's funny, you know, we got 2-3-year-old twin girls that their pits and peaks are a little, you know, flowers and rainbows. And you're like, okay, that didn't actually happen today. But for my 7- and 6-year-old sons, they'll say, you know, so-and-so was mean to me at school today. All right, well, let's talk about that, right? Mm. Like what happened? Or this happened really well and how to celebrate that. So just we have seen personally, and we're not always great at being consistent, but when we begin to interject things that aren't normally a part of our work, our daily life flow, 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there, and we're doing it together and it's not us all screaming at each other, but it's leading to something, change has happened. But I guess I'm curious from your background, what does happen? Because our family meetings, let me give you an inside look at what those look like. We've listened to your podcast today. We're all pumped up. We get 10 minutes. We sit everybody down in our sectional in our living room. Our 7- and 6-year-old are fairly mature. So they understand what mom and dad are trying to do. And they sit there for the first 2 minutes. Meanwhile, thing one and thing two, my 3-year-old beautiful girls, my twins are like jumping up and down. And now they are getting their brothers riled up. And now everybody's laughing. You've kind of lost control of the moment, right? So mm-hmm. how do we begin to help parents that don't have the more mature teenagers at home that might be more responsive or not, or those that have young kids that, like, what happens when you receive a really like resourceful piece of information, family meetings, but the family dynamic in which you live, you're dealing with maturity issues and distractions. Like, is there even anything that you could give as an encouragement to those with young kids as to like baby steps?
Yeah. Yeah. So to match the energy of the kids, like you say, the pits and the peaks stuck with your kids because it matched their energy on some level. And so if you have something particular that, let's say you have a kid who has anger attacks and starts screaming all the time, that they know when they're angry, like they know the energy of anger, and you want to introduce the idea of naming anger as opposed to acting anger out. I think this also kind of brings in what I find with the physicality is that kids are very physical too. So it may be that you don't need a 10-minute family meeting. Maybe you need the 2-minute emotion identification thing where you're like, okay, looks like you're super angry. So how about when you're super angry, we do this action, like make a physical thing. And then you say, and if you want to come out of the anger and tell me something, why you're angry, then we're going to do this action. So you can, first of all, they can express their anger. I'm really angry, so angry. And then you come down to, here's what matters to me. You can like put your hands on your heart or something that makes sense to them and say, I'm angry because I want this. So they get used to connecting emotion to what matters, because oftentimes they get separated and then kids are just acting out emotion without it being connected, or parents are just acting out emotion without it being connected. So it may be that the form of it takes more of a kind of a game or a physical thing that could take less time, that would engage them, depending on what information you're wanting to get across with them. You know, how do we interact when we're really upset about something? It could be something like that. First, we name the emotion, then we name what's important. Or if it's like, what do we do when we're late for school and, you know, something happens? How can we create some kind of a signal that's simultaneously fun, like you say, with the pits and peaks, but also tells everybody what's going on, and then shows the pathway to the thing you want to do? So there's what's happening and there's what you want to see happening. And how can those be named really clearly, so the kids are like, oh yeah, I understand the difference between I'm angry and here's what I care about. So that those things become part of your shared vocabulary. And it can have a physical component, which can really help kids connect to it. So that can be the kind of things to notice, that you might need to adapt whatever that space is where you're talking about, essentially talking about mechanisms. Kids don't know what that means, but you do. That might have to take a different form for the shape of your own family and the age of the kids. But as long as there's some kind of a space where it's about, like, this is a moment at a time where we're talking about how we do us, how we communicate, what we do together, what's not working, what's working. Yeah.
Well, that those insights, I mean, boy, parents, I hope you get out there and your kids want to be silly. And sometimes we're so serious. Sometimes we expect our kids to be older than they actually are. You know, sometimes it's easy to feel like my 7-year-old should be 30, you know, and make decisions like me, you know, so you get frustrated when you realize, okay, he's 7. Mm. But even if your kids are older, or you're let down. And I think even just that example that you just shared is really practical, because it can interject change in a meaningful way and lead to a healthy dynamic. I wonder though about when you are raising a family, you're doing life with other families, whether it's through sports, whether it's through friends, do you ever encourage, you know, people to get together and have shared values with other couples and families? And, you know, because you can train your kids in, you know, a certain way. And let's say you start to get real breakthrough in your family. You know, there's just a level of politeness that's now happening, a respect of authority. Maybe you're getting your kids on the right path, but maybe every time you have, you know, a certain family over with kids, or you go visit their house, or you do life with other people, your kids get exposed to actions that you may not, you know, want your kids to be exposed to, or behaviors. Like, how do you also work with people that may be dealing with conflict, as we would call it, with the way that, you know, other people are raising their kids, or even family members? You know, you mm-hmm. could have siblings that raise their kids a certain way. Like, are there certain steps that somebody can take, you know, to either start doing life with people that they respect, or even like having conversations? Like, that's probably a very awkward one. You know, have you ever had to deal with that, of just maybe there's another couple that does things differently, whether it's their marriage or their kids? And how do you even begin to, because we all want to avoid it, right? It's like, well, let's just mm-hmm. not talk about it. We'll just spend less time with them. And then they start mm-hmm. to realize, like, hey, you never call us anymore. You never text. So like, what? And sorry, I'm just trying to get very practical. If people don't have kids, absolutely. But maybe they're dealing with something else in their life, what happens if you have a relationship, just any relationship, let's call it that, any relationship that there's a little bit of conflict there? Like, how do you even begin to coach somebody or talk through, like, what steps to take?
Yeah. So I'd say the first thing that I think is, abandoned any attempt to change anybody else. Because it doesn't work. It may be that, you know, you may have another family where you do have similar goals, and you can then have a conversation and work together. And that's, you know, that might happen, but most of the time when there's conflict, it's not like that. And what I find also for the kids is that it's not about protecting the kids from seeing anything else, but rather building up in them the strength to notice what they're doing, the impact of it, to notice what other people are doing, the impact of it, and to make conscious decisions based on that. So it may be that another family has, you know, behaviors that you don't like. And that can be a conversation with the kids, with your own kids, around why the kind of behaviors that you're fostering are important to you, what they see happens when the other kids act this other way. So it's not about like trying to control the other people, but rather strengthen your own kids' capacity for curiosity and for critical thinking, which I think is what it boils down to. Because in any conflict, if you get into trying to tell the other person how they should be behaving, it usually ends up badly. If you start from yourself, if you do want to have a conversation, say there's a family, another family member that has kids and that you're all in the house together and it's driving you nuts, to start from yourself. So rather than saying your kids are out of control, they're driving me crazy, to start from yourself and say, I'm finding myself getting kind of nervous and frustrated here because I really see that we have different ways of working with the kids when there's conflict coming up. For example, I'm getting nervous when I see this happening because it's important to me that, for example, kids are able to be polite, when they're asking questions, let's say. And I'm wondering what you're thinking around that. I'm not sure if I'm understanding what's going on currently in the situation, but I want to understand. So starting from yourself, here's what I see. Here's what I care about. I'm curious what your thoughts are on this. And then to think about what your real request would be. Not a demand, but what's a real request? If it would be something like, it's important to me that when we're in my house, that people talk to each other in a way that feels respectful and feels polite, which doesn't mean we can't talk about things we disagree on, but how we do it is important to me. And I'd like to know, would you be willing when we're here to interact in that way? And if they say, no, that's ridiculous, you're trying to control me, then you have a clear answer. Then you make decisions. Okay, then what's my decision to make? Do I want to spend time in our house with them, for example?
Yeah. Well, it was a conversation that came up on a prior episode. One of my good friends who is a pastor at a church, we kind of delved into this episode because I think today in 2023, it's never been easier to use the word boundaries in a way that's like almost unhealthy. So what I've discovered is a lot of times people will use this word boundaries when they're upset with somebody or something that they've never actually addressed. So when you ask people like, hey, you know, when's the last time you saw your parents or you saw so-and-so? It's like, oh yeah, we don't see them anymore. We had to set up a boundary. It's like, oh, what happened? And it's like, well, they upset us. And I'm curious. So I'm like, did you talk to them about it? And they're like, well, no, we just decided that it was necessary to not spend time with them. So like because that is practical, you hope that every conversation is life-giving and you sit your friends down or whoever the person you have conflict is and you say, it is important to me to have peace in my home. And they go, you know what? I am so sorry, Dana. I did not realize that. Let me change my ways or let me be better. You know, whatever it is. Like we always hope that there's some convergence point where, you know, we can come together and have mutual understanding. But what happens when it doesn't? What happens when you have mustered up the courage to actually have a conversation with a friend or a family or somebody at work, and you acknowledge these things are important to me and it is not well received? Or in the moment, it's very passive of like, okay, that's great. And then, you know, a few days later, they come back to you after they've had time to emotionally deal with it and they unload on you. I mean, how do you also, because I do believe in boundaries. I didn't say all of that to say it is not important sometimes to set up boundaries because it is, but there is a very delicate balancing act between you've actually taken steps trying to address something, giving permission to the other party to understand how you're feeling. And it wasn't received. So you've discovered that it is important to maybe set up a boundary because you've tried to acknowledge it versus just, you don't like conflict. So you're very passive. Mm-hmm. you just don't say anything, and you know what I mean? It eats mm-hmm. you inside. So you just decide that it's mm-hmm. better to say, we've set up a boundary against this person, but they don't know that. And they've never been a part of that conversation. So they just feel like, what happened to our relationship? What do mm-hmm. you do from your world when you've had a conversation and it is not well received? Like what yeah. are there steps that somebody can take to not feel guilt and shame of maybe it is time to stop a relationship?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that gets to a really fundamental question which is what is the question between us? Sometimes if I just say to you what I think you should do, or I want your kids to do, I'm taking my strategy and telling you what it is. But maybe I don't understand what you're thinking. I'm on the strategic level, and that's very easy to get into fighting back and forth. This should happen. No, this should happen. And if a conversation, let's say a conversation went poorly, then you can consider to yourself, what is the question between us? And is that the question that we were addressing? Or were we stuck on some kind of a strategic thing about what should happen? And so if the question between you becomes clear enough that it contains both of you in a certain way, that you're both able to nod your head and say, yeah, okay, that is the question. You know, how do we have a dinner together that everybody feels good about? So if I come from my side and I say, I want a dinner where no one complains about the food, whatever it is, that's a strategy. But then that is kind of putting it on you and saying, you know, get your kids together so they stop complaining about the food. But if I say, let's figure out what the question is, and if the question between us turns out to be, what would a dinner look like that we all feel good about? Then we need information from all sides, and that invites you into a conversation. So if something went badly, probably the question between you wasn't containing you both in a way that you could both work on it and figure out what information is necessary to know, you know, what needs to happen so that, for example, the kids can settle and be comfortable. What do we need to do in advance? What hasn't happened? What's been causing the issues before? What can we do together to move toward a situation that feels good for all of us? So I think of conflict as, like we talked about before, it's not like you're going to solve it, you're going to be done, but rather it's having, like, letting your spirit kind of stay fluid so that you keep noticing where you are, keep noticing what's happening, be able to express what matters to you, ask what matters to the other person. And you can always come back and say, because people really, they want to be understood in conflict. People get into conflict because they care about something. So if you are able in yourself to take a step back with the other person and say, you know, let me try this again. I the way that last conversation went, I felt sad about that, because it's important to me that we can, you know, talk about things that matter and find ways forward. So would you be willing to have another conversation where we maybe look more at what matters to each of us around this? So that's a way to come back to it, by saying, creating a frame that's not about, I'm going to talk about this until you understand what your problem is, but rather, let's talk about this. Would you be willing to have a conversation where we looked at what matters to us?
Well, the last maybe category, that just because I have your time and this is what you do, I'm curious, because it's things I'm working on in my own life. You know, yeah. I'm the kind of person that wears my heart on my sleeve. I love people. I choose to see the best in them. And I am a safe space for many people, family members, friends, colleagues, where, you know, I am intentional about texting people, calling people, checking in. And when I ask Dana, how you doing? I'm not just doing it to pass time, but I really want to know. Well, when you do that, which is great, you also open the door up to people being like, well, blah, 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 blah. And a lot of the time, it's not with me that people are bringing things up as a friend, as a brother, as a child, whatever it may be. You are trying to understand, in a lot of situations that I've run into, is hearing of situations that's affecting the person I'm talking to with somebody else. And I mean, it could be reoccurring relationships. So every time you talk to this person, they are just broken, lesser than bitter about one particular relationship or groups of people. And when you're that person who's like the friend that they're confiding in, also just like navigating, not trying to fix it or correct it, but just also protecting yourself or giving them actual guidance that can help them. Because if you're, again, it can wear you down. If you are actively trying to work on yourself and improve yourself, and you've taken care of your mind, you've taken care of your body, you're in a good place. But a lot of the relationships you deal with are people putting things on you as a mechanism to release kind of what's on their heart, which is good for people to do. But you're surrounded all the time by negative conversations that don't really have anything to do with you. Like, how do you begin to coach people to help somebody? If you're a person that people look to and share information, is there anything that you can do, like in my world, to just like help or take a step or acknowledge, like, well, have you ever considered this? Like, because why am I saying this? I believe in family restoration, relationship restoration. And I just, man, there's a lot of hurting people out there that have broken relationships with parents, with kids, with friends, that just, when you listen as a bystander, you're like, it just sounds like you guys got to get together and like really talk it through, right? Because you're both, hurt people, right? So when you are somebody who is carrying the weight because you love people, like, how do you begin to like help in a situation where it's like, time out. Every time we talk, it can't be this conversation, or else, like, have you begun to take these steps? So how would you, even if you had a friend or somebody that was going through things with somebody else, not yourself, are there any practical steps that you could give that could help that part of the relationship?
Yeah. So of course it depends on what the other person wants. Many times people, as you say, are just looking to talk about things. And people do get into these cyclical things where they're complaining about another person and repeating, kind of acting out over and over the story. And absolutely, that's exhausting for people who are receiving, because you're receiving the energy. And what I find, because also when you work in conflict, you are constantly receiving all kinds of terrible things that are going on with people, is to stay with yourself. And recognize that it's their work to do. And there's at one point I was going to this Al-Anon for family members of alcoholics, and they have the saying, not only can you not change people, but it's none of your business what they do. And at the time I was like, yes, it is. I need to help them. And, you know, but now many years down the line, I'm like, that's absolutely right. It's none of my business what they do. And I can be present with them, and I can acknowledge it. And so when you say, for example, I heard you saying there's these repetitive things, and you just keep hearing every time you see them, they complain about the same person, that you can acknowledge your own experience. You know, it sounds like this particular thing with your mom is really repetitive and it's exhausting for you. And you keep, you can say to the person, and you keep having the same issue, keeps coming up over and over again. Is that right? They're like, yeah, she drives me nuts. Yeah. And then you can also speak from your own experience. You know, at the same time, I'm finding myself feeling kind of sad. Like what I just heard you say, Steve, was because I do have the sense that this disconnection is really causing a lot of pain in your life. So you can be present with what you've experienced. And if it does continue over and over to happen, to say, I find that I'm having a hard time continuing to talk about this because it feels so repetitive. And I'm wondering if you're interested in thinking about ways to shift things so that they, if they're like, no, it's impossible, then you can say, you know what, I think I just can't talk about this, this particular thing anymore. I am interested though, if you're interested in thinking about different ways to go about it. And if someone is interested in different ways to go about it, then to start to investigate back to this level we're talking about what matters. What do you think matters to you most in the situation? What do you think matters to the other person most in the situation? So as a mediator, which is kind of what you're talking about there, the work of a mediator is to be not on the side of either person, but to be on the side of the situation. What is happening in the situation? What are the needs on all sides? And what if we held those things together and asked a question like, you know, it seems like impossible right now, but what would it look like if we were able to have a conversation on this, what would need to be prevented? What would need to be enabled? What do people need to be able to step into this conversation? There's so much history. So there's questions you can ask about how is history impacting the way we're seeing now, the story we're telling ourselves about this. What happens to my body when I even think about the conflict? How can the person you're talking to start to notice what they as individuals can do regardless of what the other person does? That they can start to develop a mindset that is curious, even when it's hard, that's focused on needs and interests as opposed to attack and defense, that can consciously take steps back from attack and defense, even if it gets going. And even if they don't know what to do, just the motion of saying, whoa, okay, I'm back in this attack defense thing. I'm going to stop doing that. I'm going to direct my attention consciously toward curiosity. What is going on here? What matters to us each? What keeps us in this loop? What would we like to have happen? So that's a lot of things. And I think it all kind of integrates into staying with yourself, being willing to acknowledge the other person. If the other person wants to explore things, to offer the idea that they direct their attention consciously away from attack and defense toward what matters, toward the level of need and the curiosity around what would it look like if we found a way forward that really worked for both people? What would it look like? Even if it seems impossible, just to imagine, just to open the brain space that is like looking for that possibility is a drastically different place to be than complaining about how things are.
Well, I'll give you some time to begin to think about a staple of the One Big Thing, which is a segment at the end that I do start, stop, and continue. So we'll come to that in a minute. But I want to thank you for sharing what you did. There is another topic that we didn't get into today that I'd love to have you back or have a side conversation, which I think for our listeners would be really important. What happens when you have a figure in the office space, an authority figure, a manager, a CEO, in kind of knowing when it's time to have conversations that could improve a situation or possibly leave a field because it's just not being received? So we can do that at another time. But I thought for this episode, we touched on a whole lot of different relationships that I really think do affect your personhood, your DNA as a person, which is acknowledging that family is tough. Being married is hard. Being a parent is hard, but we get to choose our hard and we get to see the blessings in all of it. And I always try to tell people and first of all, work on myself. I cannot point the finger at another person if I am not willing to self-reflect on, Steve, you really dropped the ball, you know, the way you said that to your kids. Or self-talk is big to me. I'm not insane, I promise you. But self-talk is big to me to really think about where did that thought come from and why did I respond that way and to make things right. But I will tell you that if you're in the midst of conflict as a parent or with a spouse, with a family member, start with yourself. Get your heart in the right place, but also recognize that it does take two people to change a situation. And maybe there are just people that are out there today that are hoping that they can change or get the other person, but they have to also want to be willing to change. But I think a big part of it is first working on ourselves and making sure that there is nothing that we are signaling, whether it's unconsciously with our body or the way that we speak or the tone. The tone is a big thing with me. Tone and communication is a choice. Even though we all go through things, we still get to choose our tone and our attitude for how we say things. So this is the stuff that's really practical for me. But I think for having you on the show, I do want to include in the show notes both a link to your book so that if people are interested, they can go purchase it. But after the show, I'll also get a link for the book that you talked about to help parents. But for being a guest on my show, I wanted to thank you as we open up to the start, stop, continue. I have every guest share one thing that they want to start doing, stop doing, and continue doing. So we'll go right there. But if there is also anything else that you wanted to touch on before we get to that, give you the space to do that as well.
I think for me, what all of the things that we have been talking about boil down to is this idea of developing the mindset of looking at every conflict as proposing constructive change. So that even though conflict can feel so horrible, that it contains already the information you need to figure out how to move forward. So there's a lot of despair I see in people in conflict, a sense of hopelessness. And I find hope or a sense of possibility arises when we start asking ourselves questions like, what would it look like if this were to change? What are the things that I'm doing internally that are kind of getting in the way of that? What am I doing that supports the situation? So that we start to see conflict not as kind of this like destructive wall that's falling on us, but as a puzzle that tells us how we can move forward and in a really practical way, saying, what is this telling us about what matters to me and to the other person, so that we are really always taking info from all sides and not just trying to jam our own strategy through, and letting emotion, like we were talking about, letting emotion guide us to what matters. So I always think about emotion as like a flag that is being waved by needs, so that the emotion in itself is not so helpful. Emotion that's connected to needs is very helpful.
And I think what I've discovered listening to you, that was an encouragement for me, is life really is a dance. And it's not, you had a conversation at one point, you stuck your flag in the sand and you said, from now on, our family is not going to be screamers or hollowers or over-discipliners. We are going to right this ship. And 2 days later, you're right back to where you were. There are some things that you still have to unwork. There are habits. Mm-hmm. Even when you do dance or you play sports or the mechanics, we all develop routines and rhythms to life that we, driving your car, you can drive to a location and not even realize how you got there. Our muscle memory, our mind memory is such a real tangible thing that if you are serious about real life change, healthy relationships, peace in your life, just realize it's probably going to take work to get out of that and practice and routine. And just because you might fall every once in a while doesn't mean that the move is not executionable. It just means that it takes work. So I think you also did a really nice job of reminding myself and all of our listeners that life is never just a one-time event, but it takes work. It takes practice. And why? Because it's worth living. So why don't we jump right into start, stop, continue? I don't know. Usually what I have my guests do is say, one thing I want to start doing, followed up, and then kind of the same thing with stop and continue, but you can take it away.
Okay. So I was thinking about this when you asked it. One thing that I want to start doing is to make more time in the day for reading, because I find I end up working and seeing people and doing things, and then I don't have time to read the many books that I'd like to read. I'd like to stop checking the news multiple times a day. I find that while I need the information, there is so much there's so much despair and difficulty in the world that can take on such weight against the kind of work that we can do. So I want to understand what's happening, and then I want to use most of my energy to work toward how do we create active peace inside of our the places we are. How do we spread those out? How does that become an international thing? I think that if the focus doesn't remain on the fact of just what you were naming before, that this kind of work that we're already all doing of how we interact around difficulty is not a one-time thing. It's an ongoing thing. And having that in mind as a mindset becomes kind of a relief eventually, because you realize it's not failure when conflict comes up. It's an opportunity to understand that there's needs that have not yet been met. So I want to focus my attention, you know, more proportionately on my work that way. And one thing that I've been doing over the last year, that I'd like to continue doing, is to build ways to work with people over longer time periods. So, for example, just yesterday I launched something called a Year of Conflict Thinking, where I'm working with people for a year as they work through whatever project they're on, as they think about conflict. And this feels really gratifying to me, because I find the more people have a way to practice consistently, because it's not easy, like you say. If you don't have people to work with or think with, that's why it can be really helpful with your partner to have a common practice where when conflict comes up, it's not like a disaster, but it's like, oh, okay, it's a conflict. What's going on? So to find ways to have longer arcs of work with people, that's something I want to continue.
I love that. And that's why doing this at the end Even if for some reason you couldn't relate to Dana, which I don't know how that could have possibly happened. Maybe there was something in one of those three that she said. And I know, you know, for me, the second one that you talked about the news consumption, I think it's great to stay informed, but you can also become very influenced by headlines and things that you read to the point that you are a shell of yourself, because it's just very hard to emotionally deal with the own responsibilities in your life and then the weight of things that are happening in the world at the same time and just feeling the sense of despair. So I appreciated you sharing that. And I hope that for those that had never heard you before, that they would become a fan, they would read your book, they'd stay in contact. We'll put contact information in the show notes if that's okay with you for how to get in contact with you. Yeah. But this has been great. Honestly, I never know where conversations are going to go, but I'm always pleasantly surprised that they're where they should have gone. And I hope that if you are new to the One Big Thing, again, this isn't your last listen, but maybe it's a first stop that exposes you to some of the incredible guests that I have had the honor and privilege of interviewing up to this point. But Dana, thanks for coming on the One Big Thing. I hope this has been a great experience for you.
Yeah, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed being here and talking with you about this.